This is the Alembic Files. I'm Al, and we have with us Eric the Blacksmith. How are you, Eric?
All right, Al. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you back. We finally got through 15 parts A, B, and C, so we're off to something new. And what are we going to do today?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more to the Anti-Federalists, of course. And I mentioned last time that the Corporation of the United States has law enforcement which is not bound to protect an individual. I have a great article here, The Con of the United States. I may have sent this to you. If I haven't, I'll send it to you, and it might even be worth sending again. And it talks about a number of the things that the our friends, the Informer in Montgomery, talked about. And it goes into, sort of a myth-busting exercise. And it's really sort of a Cliff Notes version. I don't know, it's maybe 10 pages, 8, 9, 10 pages. And it talks about a number of different things. It starts with the 13th century, talks about the pontiff, it talks about canon law. And there was something in here that really caught my eye. I'm trying to find it. It talked about a couple of Supreme Court cases, and it did mention Paddleford. It also talked about...
Okay.
I'm sorry?
No, that's interesting. Somebody else cited Paddleford, huh?
Okay. And this is a Supreme Court case. It was Fox versus Custis. Fox versus Custis. 712F2D8488, Fourth Circuit Court from 1983. Okay. A couple of other cases. Wells versus Walker. And Ketchum versus Alameda County. I mentioned the particulars from Fox versus Custis. It was the first case listed, but to save a lot of syllables, what I'll do is I'll just send you this, and you can, if you'd like, you can just upload it so people can refer to it and they won't have to listen to my babbling of all these numbers and letters.
All right, are you going to capsulize it, though?
Yes. And basically it's this. Members of the public have no constitutional right to be protected by the state from harm inflicted by third parties. Okay. Another case was Bowers versus DeVito. This was from 1982. Okay, Ketchum versus Alameda County was from 1987. These are relatively recent cases, Al. Wells versus Walker was from 1988. Okay. Now, here was another case, MAPCO Incorporated versus Carter from 1978. No constitutional right exists under the Ninth Amendment or to any other provision of the Constitution of the United States to trust the federal government and to rely on the integrity of its pronouncements. Which sounds to me like a pretty clear-cut explanation that we are indeed not a party to this thing, the Constitution. Members of the public have no right to petition for a redress of grievance. The United States District Court for the District of Columbia in the case of, quote, We the People Foundation Incorporated et al. Versus the United States. And there are some numbers here, and it goes, admitted in the Civil War era, however, the U.S. Congress enacted rules abolishing the duty to respond, a change later sanctioned by the Supreme Court. And this is in the Yale Law Journal. Okay. Furthermore, the U.S. Federal Judge Emmett G. Sullivan, in his order and opinion, upheld the position of the United States et al. To deny the human rights of we the people et al., the right of petition, in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia on August 31st, 2005. Okay. So there are no sovereign citizens here in the U.S. It's an oxymoron. And there's a definition I have of sovereignty.
Yeah, would you read that, please? I mean, you see, here's one of the things that I assume is what's going on out there, and I think it's too much of a treacherous thing to try. And that is what I guess some people are doing, and that is declaring themselves sovereign citizens. But so there wouldn't be any by nature, by design, I guess you would say nature is probably not the right word, by design. So you have to go ahead and then assume the status. But I want to hear what it states there.
Okay, now this is Black's Law, the 5th edition, page 1252. Sovereignty, the supreme absolute and uncontrollable power by which any independent state is governed. Supreme political authority, paramount control of the Constitution and frame of government and its administration. There are three periods here, so it continues, but I guess they got the meat of it.
Okay.
That's the definition of sovereignty. And I do want to allude to something I noticed. I was at my dad's house the other day, and he has a dictionary. It's a Webster's dictionary, if memory serves, from the late 40s, 1950, 49, around there. And just for burps and grins, I looked up the word terrorist. Now, we've talked about this.
Sure.
But I looked at that definition, and it said a system of government.
Yeah. As the old dictionaries will. But I know when you get past 2001, and it might have even started earlier, I had taken a look in the library in which I worked, and I think I might have gone back as far as 2000 and saw a change. But certainly after 2001, if you go ahead and you look, you will find now that it's more or less pinned to the people being terrorists upon the government rather than the other way around. There's one point I want to make real quick, which is probably not the way to do it. But here's what's bothered me about a lot of these people who are trying to push forth their sovereign status and supposedly exempt themselves or get themselves out of whatever it is, you know, using driver's license or whatever. It's that nobody controls you or you know, you're it gets almost biblical, okay? That you are a person in the eyes of God, da-da-da-da-da, right? And no one can own you. But it also, I've seen it with people who are doing this to say that no man can rule you. And that sounds great, except when you get into what kind of laws are good for the commonwealth of people. Like stop signs are a good idea. And stopping at them is a really good idea. I mean, if you were, so here's where I'm going with this. If you take that mentality, what's scary to me is it becomes the exact opposite of what is biblical, and that is that, what do you call it, axiom or dictum from the occultist, which is, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Well, the whole of the law is do what thou wilt. That's great. If everybody wants to do that, what do you think we're going to have? We're probably going to have anarchy.
I was going to say, yeah, with no regard for life or for other people's situations or feelings.
Yeah.
You know, it's much like these Wall Street parasites who operate without any kind of compunction, and they'll just steamroll people and their lives, and they're heartless.
Well, so you can see that a society cannot be held together if you have, who knows what, 300 million solitary units doing whatever they will. It cannot work. What I don't like is if you take it to the extreme, as I saw some people did, to me it's just the same language as the occult.
Yes.
So we all have to agree that there's probably some good ideas that would make it helpful for everyone if they followed them. I guess we would call them laws, certainly on a local level. I mean, just things that make sense. Like I said, you got a car, stop at a stop sign, right? We can all agree
that. I only mention the Wall Street douchebags because they're the ones that are the most fun to bang on. But there's certainly plenty of examples of lawlessness through this country.
Well, I mean, it's arguable that everybody probably would, if given to their own means. I mean, that's what we went through with, what was it, Heart of Darkness and Joseph Conrad. You know, that if man were left alone, he would do only one thing, and that is, if you will, ascend to become as corrupt as possible. And they also use that, of course, as one of the storylines in Apocalypse Now, supposedly based on that book. So the thing is, if we understand that the heart is dark, then you cannot leave it without some kind of set of rules that make life work every day. I mean, let's not get ridiculous. Now, the extent to which laws go, we all understand now, is crazy. But you know, you cannot go ahead and say, I don't answer to anyone. Well, in fact, you do. You will.
Yes, well, it's interesting because I've heard the definition or some of the philosophies of a lot of these Satanists practicing whatever one wants to call it, and they think that the afterlife, no matter how badly they behave, is one giant party where everybody has, you know, orgies forever. That seems to be a running theme through some of these philosophies.
Well, if you once again, if you don't believe in a god or anything, you can probably make it up as you go along, and that's really what you have. They're all engineering it and imagineering, I should say, too, an afterlife. So, you know, okay, great. Does that make you right? No. But
no, of course not.
It allows them to slide past everything else because basically what you don't want to be is obedient. So,
right, it gives them a justification. It gives them an excuse.
Yeah. So this bit about being a sovereign citizen, you know, okay. But the thing is, and here's the other thing. I mean, if you go back to the words of Jesus Christ in the Gospels, I mean, he knows that everybody's going to be in tow to corrupt governments. He made that very clear on a number of occasions, but of course that all gets overlooked. Or other scriptures are pulled out which do not really apply any longer from the Old Testament and those that were supplanted because of his birth, death, and resurrection. So, you know, here we are, and that is, he understands that government is oppressive. He is not somebody who has ever asked his followers to create a theocracy. That's something that Christians nowadays are taking upon themselves. They always have. They're idiots if they want to do that. Because the one thing that the Lord said, I mean, what did he say? What's the Great Commission? Go run for government? No, share the gospel. That's it. Boom. That's all.
Let your walk be detected.
Huh?
And let your walk be detected.
Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't to have a theocracy. He said that's, you know, it's not going to happen until he returns. And even then, he's going to take it off this planet. So, you know, what are you guys doing? We've been through this too. Nobody's listening anymore. Everybody's running with some of this stuff. How it got started, who knows, but it's amazing. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, drives Sandhu up a wall and others. When you see, like, this is what you're doing in your church. Okay, you're all born again Christians, and this is what you're doing. You're going to put candidates up for running for what? Why? It's a cesspool. Why bother?
But people anyway, just love to have their ears tickled, Al.
They are not paying attention. And I remember 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when there was this thought about, oh, it says that there'll be a deception within the church. You know, everybody was trying to wonder what it was. Well, you were part of it then, and you're part of it now, which is not listening, not reading the Word, not understanding what Christ said, and listening to pastors who are pushing doctrine that got started who knows where. You know,
well, also the 503C, what is it, 503Cs? And
501C.
That's it. The tax exemption seems to be the wedge and the ramp that many of these churches are using today to laugh all the way down to the bank. And some of these pastors are living mighty large.
Well, and even if they're not, the thing is, who told you to get into an agreement with the state? This is another thing that goes back. I mean, and even if you go back to what Christ said to the Pharisees, who presented the coin with Caesar's likeness on it. He says, you know, give unto Caesar what is. No, it's let the state have what the state is. That's got nothing to do with me. And even later on, with the time that he and Peter go wherever they went, and they get into the story about, well, you know, the king's children don't pay tribute, but strangers do. And what it comes down to is that, what are we? Are we the king's children? And it's like, no, well, then we'll pay the tribute. Because we're not part of this whole situation. And
it's a good example, I think, of this rancher out in Idaho. Is it Idaho?
No, Nevada.
Yes, thank you. Nevada. Where he was not paying fees. There's something to do with the tortoise. I'm not exactly sure of the details, but I'm listening to the radio, and I don't remember who it was, but they were talking about militia people coming to help. And this guy was talking about, oh, well, one person's coming from this state, and three people are coming from that state. And I just had to shake my head, because you're basically, you know, you're throwing feathers at tanks here.
Well, there's something else that's going on, and when I got that first article sent to me by whoever it was, I think it was Framemaker. All right, I'm looking at it, and of course, you know, it's sad. You have the federal government that's going to crack down on this guy who's had a ranch, what, the family's had it for 80 years or so.
But here's
the
yeah.
But here's the point. When I look at the comments that were written underneath, it immediately devolved into people blaming lefties and righties. If you went back and took a look at the comments there, it is a perfect example of what's going on. And these people are supposed to...
Can I offer something here?
Sure, absolutely.
Real quick.
Yeah.
Once you get into the left and or right, any kind of element of that discussion, of that kind of making a point...
is lost.
You've been rendered into irrelevance.
Yeah, no, it's true when, you know, I said, if you think that you can solve, that you have the solution to what's going wrong, because everybody knows something's wrong in this country. But the first thing that's out of their mouth as to how they can remedy it is it's the other party. So as soon as you open your mouth and say Republicans or Democrats, it's already shot. Forget it. You don't get it. But that's exactly what these people were doing. In the comments section, and like I said, they come to that story because they kind of get it. They're probably patriots or whatever. And what does it devolve into? A lefty-righty thing. And then somebody's arguing about, well, who are the first peoples here? Well, was the Native Americans. Oh, no, the Chinese were here first. And I'm looking at all this noise, and I'm going, here is exactly why the patriots will never, have never, and will never work. That's
it. No, they won't, and... It's interesting to note that Alex Jones was on Michael Savage's show the other day.
And what?
And so it goes.
See, here's the other thing.
I have to say, Al, this country, I really think of what, who was it? The late Hunter S. Thompson. About the long plastic hallway?
Yeah, full of thieves and
this
pimps.
This country is a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs.
Yeah.
When I was thinking about these laws, there was an editorial in my local paper not too long ago about these new gun laws, and one individual wrote something, an excerpt from Atlas Shrugged, and I just wanted to read it really quick. Where it's Dr. Ferris. I have not read Atlas Shrugged. I've read about it. I plan to read it, but I found it to be very interesting. The whole story is pretty fascinating. Did you really think that we want those laws to be observed, said Dr. Ferris? We want them broken. You'd better get it straight that it's not a bunch of Boy Scouts you're up against. Then you'll know that this is not the age for beautiful gestures. We're after power, and we mean it. You fellows were pikers, but we know the real trick, and you'd better get wise to it. There's no way to rule innocent men. The only power any government has is the power to crack down on criminals. Well, when there aren't enough criminals, one makes them. One declares so many things to be a crime that it becomes impossible for men to live without breaking laws. Who wants a nation of law-abiding citizens? What's there in that for anybody? But just pass the kind of laws that can neither be observed nor enforced nor objectively interpreted, and you create a nation of lawbreakers, and then you cash in on guilt. Now that's the system, Mr. Reardon. That's the game, and once you understand it, you'll be much easier to deal with. This is from Atlas Shrugged. Now let me read one section again, and let me bring it back to another thing. Just pass the kind of laws that can neither be observed nor enforced nor objectively interpreted. You know what that says to me? Constitutional Convention, Constitution of the United States. It was both a servant to tyranny and freedom at one and the same time.
Well, it gave the appearance of one and the substance of the other.
Exactly. That well said. Yes.
And then they go ahead and they pop off and they give all these like memorable quotes. And I don't know how many buildings in this country are inscribed with some of these. And with as many as they offer, and Jefferson's the absolute worst, that their being said something completely different. I mean, Jefferson is the biggest two-face that we've ever had anywhere near the government.
I think that way of Hamilton, but Jefferson's definitely in there.
Well, sure, the same thing. But, you know, Jefferson is the one that, of course, was a president. And so, you know, you can almost not get through any library, school, or whatever and not see one of his quotes.
That's true.
Whereas Hamilton, I think, was less...
He was less conspicuous.
And he was less of a phony. I mean, he was a Turk, and that's all he meant to be. You know, it's like, let him eat cake, very much a monarchist at heart. You know, and so was Jefferson, except that he talked one thing and did another. And anybody who presumes to write or edit a Bible, my goodness, brother, you are in the dirt room without a doubt. Oh, man, that is the all-time vanity.
It's interesting you mention that, too, because I found a book. I didn't purchase it, but I found a reference to it. Let me see if I can find it here. And while I'm looking for it, I'll mention that these school massacres, knifing, shootings, there was an Enoch Brown school massacre back in 1764 where the indigenous peoples attacked school children. Let me see if I can find this. Let's see here.
I do remember that. Where did this happen, in Pennsylvania?
This was in Franklin County, near present Green Castle. Enoch Brown, inside were the schoolmaster, Enoch Brown, and a number of young students. This was, on July 26th of 1764, four Delaware, Lenape American Indian warriors entered a settler's log schoolhouse in the province of Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And that was in Franklin County, near present Green Castle.
Well, where's Green Castle?
Brown pleaded with the warriors to spare the children before being shot and scalped. And it goes on and talks about it. But it's, to me, it just brings back the old axiom, there's nothing new under the sun. And I guess because we've seen it in our time, we think it's the only time it ever happened. Of course it isn't. Anyway, there was a book that I saw on Amazon. It was called Jefferson's Curon. And it talked about Jefferson, his involvement with a Curon that he had, the study of Muslims, and I cannot find it. I don't have it in front of me, but it talked about his involvement and the study of the Quran. And I go back to the modern day situations and dynamics with Muslims in the country today, and the whole hornet's nest that's being stirred up. Especially, who was it that wrote the letter? Was it Pike supposedly wrote a letter predicting three world wars, where the third world war would be the Muslims being pitted against the Christians and the Jews? I'm not exactly sure here. I don't know if I'm quoting.
That letter was, yes, the Pike-Mazzini letter that, like I said, Bill Still years ago told me in an interview that he did in fact see it. I don't know. It was supposed to be in the London Museum. Who knows? But the thing is, whether it is or not, I mean, that's probably what's going to happen. I don't know if he got as specific as mentioning all the religions at the time, but specifically mentioning, but the point was it would be over religious intolerance, if you will.
Okay.
So, I mean, and that's what you see going on now. And, it makes me laugh because it's the same old story. How many Christians that call themselves Christians are really zealous for the Lord? How many Jews who supposedly obey the Pentateuch or the Torah are really all zealous for their religion, except on the holidays, like Christians are? Well, how many Muslims do you think? I work with a bunch of Muslims, probably about. My point is, working with the Muslims, you didn't even know they were Muslim until they didn't show up in November because of Ramadan. You know, and like the Jews don't show up in October for whatever, Rosh Hashanah. And, the Christians don't show up at Easter. So, I mean, however, as you well know, if you want to get the population all upset and excited about something, try to find or create the biggest radicals and loon jobs you can find, and then hold them up as representative of the whole group. So the idiot Christians always get picked, the idiot Jews always get picked, and the idiot Muslims always get picked as representative of everybody. Therefore, everyone's crazy. All right,
yeah.
Now, go ahead. You can say something about a book. You got the book?
Yes, it's Denise A. Spellberg, Thomas Jefferson's Curon, Islam and the Founders.
He's amazing.
There's a book description, which I consider to be somewhat of a fluff piece for Jefferson, but I'll just read a couple of sentences of it. In this original and illuminating book, Denise A. Spellberg reveals a little-known but crucial dimension to the story of American religious freedom, a drama in which Islam played a surprising role. In 1765, 11 years before composing the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson bought a Quran. This marked only the beginning of his lifelong interest in Islam, and he would go on to acquire numerous books on Middle Eastern languages, history, and travel, taking extensive notes on Islam as it relates to English common law. Jefferson sought to understand Islam, notwithstanding his personal disdain for the faith. I'll just sort of interject something. What about his personal disdain for Christianity? I'll continue. A sentiment prevalent among his Protestant contemporaries in England and America. But unlike most of them, by 1776, Jefferson could imagine Muslims as future citizens of his new country. And it has several critical reviews, positive, negative, middling. And it caught my eye when I saw it. I had no idea that he even knew what a Quran was, but I suppose these guys were pretty well educated.
Well, but I mean, again, I mean, no religion is spared his scrutiny, I guess. What a jerk. Christmas. So he despoils the Bible and the Quran. I mean, why didn't you just go, you know, you should get on after the Pentateuch also. Anyway. All right, be that as it may. But again, it's all about propaganda, and it works, and it works even better nowadays here in the United States, because with all the information that's blitzing everybody, it's even easier to do because nobody's asking questions. Nobody's doing any kind of critical analysis or questioning about what's going on. They just sit there and they just like sponges absorb this kind of stuff. It's amazing.
I think a lot of people know that something's wrong on a very innate level, but what happens? How do you navigate that? How do you find a source point? How do you, you know, reconcile what is happening today with how it started? And I think that's that's a question a lot of people can't answer.
Well, they do. They'll point to the other party being the problem. Honest to God. First thing out of the mouth will be, if you're a Democrat, oh, it's a Republican. If you're a Republican, oh, it's a Democrat. That's the first thing they say. They don't stand back and take a look at their lives and assess what has happened to them. Maybe you got better jobs along the line. Maybe you got paid more. But you know what? You paid more money to the government. You got less for it. You've had how much of your money stolen by banks and finance companies with impunity? Oh, they go in front of a bunch of senators, you know, who look like so old they fart dust. And they get yelled at for a while. And they're like, they sit there. They don't even shield their disgust at having to be there. I mean,
they don't hide their disdain.
No.
I think that people, well, let me reiterate that. I'll restate it. People can answer it, but how do you answer that question rationally? And a lot of people don't. They go with emotion. They go with preconceived notions. And hey, I did for a very long time.
Their rationale.
At some point.
But their rationale, they think, is rational because it's based on mainstream garbage. It's based on subjective. I mean, if you're going to sit there and tell me how great the GOP is because of Rush Limbaugh, I mean, are you serious? And the same stuff with the Democrats. I can hardly stand whoever that's out there with that he-she on MSNBC. God, she never shuts up. I can't believe it. She comes on the show.
Are
she opens her mouth. Huh?
Coulter?
No, she's Republican. No, who's?
Oh, I'm sorry. You said he, she, and that's what I glommed onto.
Well, Coulter, as far as I can see, is if anything, is a little slutty, but
I can't remember too. What
her name is. She got a short haircut, you know, dark hair. But she opens up the show and she doesn't stop. I mean, the whole show is one sentence. I'm amazed. Anyway, they stink too. But the thing is, nobody stands back and says to themselves, something's not right here. Government hasn't really performed its function, though they think it has. And you can go on and on. But again, they go back to what they've been told, and they don't think for themselves. I mean, that a person with as limited brain capacity as I did could at least stand back and go, you know what, something's not right here. I mean, really, something's not right here. Gee, anybody can do that.
Something's very wrong.
All right, we're at the bottom of the show, the bottom of the hour here. Since we don't have a clock anyway, so just be forewarned, we're halfway through whatever it is we're doing.
I have an interesting article here about North Carolina and their involvement with the anti-federalist efforts. And I find it interesting and how they were very easily dismissed. It's tempting to dismiss the anti-federalists for the U.S. Constitution that they opposed is a sacred document to most modern Americans. under that Constitution, the United States grew rapidly in population, wealth, and territory to become, by the late 20th century, the world's only superpower. Whatever its failings, no other political regime, by most conventional measures of accomplishment, has been more successful. North Carolina's anti-federalists have been too easily dismissed. I just interject here that North Carolina was the other standout, along with Rhode Island, that most bitterly opposed the Constitution. I'll resume. One Federalist described them as, quote, a blind, stupid set that wished damnation to their country, unquote. They were among the most bitter of the bitter enders, blocking ratification of the Constitution at the Hillsborough Convention in July of 1788, even after the document had been approved by 11 other states. Not until November 1789, after George Washington had been president for 7 months, did North Carolina finally join the Union. The most serious indictment that can be leveled against North Carolina's anti-federalists may not be their opposition to the Constitution. For many, if not most, Americans opposed ratification. A majority of North Carolinians certainly did. North Carolina's eventual acceptance of the Constitution, reflected only a temporary shift in public opinion, one driven in part by political necessity. In all likelihood, the Constitution granted more powers to the new national government than were absolutely essential to the survival of the Union. By 1787, the new nation's political elite recognized the need to give Congress the power to tax and to regulate trade. Interesting how he talks about the political elite. With the few repairs most Americans were willing to make, the Articles of Confederation might have operated as well as the Constitution has. The principal fears of the anti-federalists that the Senate would become a bastion of aristocratic privilege, that an imperial president would overawe a complacent Congress, and that an intrusive federal court system would engender costly and oppressive litigation do not sound today like 18th century paranoia. And it goes on. I think it's a pretty good write-up. I'm trying to recall who wrote it. I don't have the name in front of me, but I'll send you this as well.
Do you know when this was written?
It's fairly recently.
Okay.
I'm going to say within the past 10 years, maybe 20. Yeah, and it's got some sources listed at the end. And he goes into some other points of history at that era. You know, the 1800 Republicans or the Jeffersonian Republicans, radicals turned anti-federalists, turned Republicans in North Carolina. It's a pretty good article with some pretty good information in it. Let's see here. What else did I find? Oh, gosh, I'm sitting on all kinds of stuff here. And I can't help but to go back and think about how a lot of the things that Kenneth Royce talked about in Hologram of Liberty have been quite on the mark. And I really have to go back to the analogy he used when he talked about the natural history experiment that he was able to work with, how you had your carnivores and you had your herbivores, and how a very slight imbalance would wipe the whole system out in time. And he goes on to say, and I have to agree with him in this, that the Constitution was designed intentionally. And we've talked about this, but it just somehow never loses its relevance to me, especially when I see the events of today and how things have devolved to how they are, and they're going to devolve a lot further, boys and girls. They really are. I hate to say it, but they are. How the Constitution was basically designed to ensure a tyrannical system of government over the horizon.
That's another thing I wanted to point out about that incident in Nevada. And that is when you mess with the federal government or the federal government messes with you, you have no rights, not that you have them anyway, you have no rights and they do what they will. And that's all there is to it. And that's been shown time and time again. People talk about, oh, you know, we have posse comitatus and we have habeas corpus. No, we don't. They throw that out every time they have to. And it's already been shown in our lifetimes of speaking to you and myself. We forget about the federal troops being called out during Eisenhower and Kennedy's reign. All right? Posse comitatus, yeah, forget it. You know, widow suits them, fine. But they do what they want, and there's nothing that any of the citizens can do. So, again, when you go against the federal government, that's the corporation, like any corporation that has one goal, and that is to continue its existence. And it will do anything that it has to. And that's where it pulls up that patriotic facade, right, for everybody to shut up and listen and do as they're told, and then they do exactly what they wish behind it. They give you this veneer of democracy, which is really not a good thing anyway, and then they act totalitarian. So, I mean, not many of us... Huh?
I was going to say, aren't Posse Comitatus and the other one there, I can't remember it
habeas
off the top
corpus.
Of my head. Habeas corpus, thank you. Aren't they privileges anyway?
Well, it says that in the Constitution, by the way, which I think is interesting. And I've heard how many people dance around that, not wanting it to be the truth. So they make up their own reality, which is amazing. When I have to sit there and watch their supposed logical jumps, it's like, get out of here. What does it say? What does it say in black and white? It says right from the beginning, habeas corpus is a privilege. It also goes on with that wonderful accept clause that we've all learned to love and cherish, the accept clause or the unless clause or the notwithstanding clause. You know, well,
it stands out like the sore thumb.
Well, it even says, it says that in the habeas corpus that, you know, it cannot be, I don't know what the language is. It cannot be rescinded or whatever, except, well, then don't use cannot. You know what I mean? It cannot. Well, it can it? So you see
that's like giving somebody $10 and saying, well, it's yours, but you can't spend it unless you ask me first.
Yeah. You put conditions on it, so that means that the absolutism that you started the sentence off with is negated. But
that's
what happens. But anyway, when you get into the wonderful world of the federal government, forget it. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Honest to goodness.
Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked that story about that was sent to us by Eric about the guy that was working for Federal Express and had decided that he wasn't going to pay taxes. He was an opt-out. Not a guy owes over $1 million in fines, penalties, and all this other stuff, and he's going to be doing 3 years, and when he gets out, they're going to hit him again.
He's in the Gray Bar Hotel, and he's basically going to be paying for the rest of his life.
Yeah, in other words, so what? I mean, what do we really achieve by this? And when you were talking about all these people going to come out, just like they did with that guy Brown in New Hampshire, everybody's out there banging the drum, everybody showed up when the feds were outside, and then he got whisked away with his wife, and nobody knows where they are anymore, you know, and... All the bands and all the falderal all disappeared. Nobody even remembers that happened anymore. But they're all there. Yeah, you know, all behind Ed Brown. Yeah, sure you are. What, did you visit him in jail recently? Oh, you didn't? Why was that? These people are just like, they're playing guns. It's like when we were 10 years old and played guns.
I haven't heard anything about Ed and Elaine Brown lately.
No.
I'm sure they're in some black hole somewhere.
Yeah.
Never to see daylight again. And they were basically left to hang in the breeze.
And so was Eddie Kane. Eddie Kane has never had his day in court. And this is the guy that was helping Wesley Snipes in that famous case about opting out of the tax. Okay, now Snipes, I don't know, he paid a fine. Maybe he did, like, community service. I mean, he's out and about now. Kane, you can't find him. They've been bouncing him around from all kinds of institutions. He was in a county institution down here. And there's another thing. He went down to Panama where they have no extradition. Guess what? Two FBI went down there and said, hey, guess what? We kidnapped you. You're coming back. How do you like that? You know?
It reminds me of how Jones is protected. You know, he does a lot of stuff that would get you and I a concrete sandwich. And he just seems to walk out of it like he's some kind of Teflon Don.
I'll tell you what. If any of you listening to this, I don't care what you think about Jones. I'm going to tell you right now, this guy is a bitch. And I tell you, I would not want to be in his database, folks. You know, if you order stuff from him or whatever, I'd get out of here as fast as I can because sooner or later they're going to hit him up and he's going to say, well, I had to give up names. I'm going to tell you that's exactly what's going to happen. And some of you who have no idea what you got involved in are going to wind up in front of federal judges. And you're going to.
Yeah, he and his ilk are set up as steam valves. I'm convinced of that. The Limbaughs, the Hannitys, the Savages, the Jones, and I do lump him in with them. And I spell his name J-O-N-E, dollar sign.
Listen, there was a time...
set up as steam valves and basically as a foil, a straw man, a straw dog, however you want to describe it. But they are not what they seem. The old saying, wolves in sheep's clothing, fits perfectly.
there was a time back around maybe 02, 03, around in that time, you know, that Jones would pop up on Fox. Fetzer would pop up on Fox. Stephen Jones. We all got excited thinking, oh, we'll finally get something in there, you know. And they get ridiculed, or they look like idiots trying to say a lot in a little time. And, of course, anybody who's ever done what's her face? The woman who was who got drummed out of being the co-anchor with Matt Lauer. Anyway, Ann Curry.
Okay.
Ann Curry had Jesse Ventura on, who I think is a phony also. The only reason why he got into conspiracy because it was money to be made and he had name recognition.
A lot of money.
Well, she had him on, but of course, she asked one question, he goes to answer it, and then she's on to the next question. Well, do you mean, like, in other words, it's like, look, what do you want to do here, hon? You want to do one question and get that done thoroughly? Or are you going to just jump around and make me look an idiot trying to run around like I had, you know, two bags of groceries and my pants are falling down? You know, it's like, stop. But my point is that anybody who gets onto those shows, when Jones showed up on Coast to Coast, they're tools, all right? It's not a good thing for any of us. They're tools. And I think Fetzer is one also. Never saw somebody much trouble.
Jones, he revealed himself completely and totally to me when he showed up at an Austin Second Amendment rally and
took it over.
did his thing and just took it over, yeah, and behaved like a total ass. That told me all about him that I ever needed to know.
When you walk around and pull that kind of crap off and feel you're doing it, in fact, and you may be and can do this with impunity, then that tells me you're connected.
He's connected in so many ways it's not even funny. I mean, anybody else would have been cuffed and stuff. They would have had the silver bracelets on, and they would have been sitting in the back of a police cruiser waiting to get their mugshot taken.
Oh,
but he walks around like he's, you know, a big man on campus. I mean, come on, people. Put two and two together, will you?
I wanted to tell you also with that story about the gentleman with FedEx.
Yep.
You know, who was trying to do the sovereign citizen thing and got, you know, like a million years. All the patriots that were there, or not all of them, but he had a patriot following. And what happened was, after he got slammed, they're squatting on his house and his property.
All of them like a cheap suit, huh?
Oh, don't you love it? God almighty. Ay, ay, ay.
You know, it's the dragon. Yep, that's exactly it. You know, some days you're the pigeon, some days you're the statue. Well, I guess he was the statue in a big way.
Oh, yeah, but there's all the people that are pumping their fists and saying, right on, you know. It's like, well, why don't you get out there and do it, bro? Why don't you get out of the stands and come down on the field? But it's ridiculous. And I see these kids that are coming into this. They have no idea what's going on. Most of them aren't even old enough to, huh?
I talked my young friend at work out of this sovereignty thing. He showed me the paperwork. I laughed, and I sent him the interviews that you did with The Informer. And he got religion real fast.
Well, a lot of the young people who are into it aren't even old enough to realize what has gone wrong. But what they do are they're probably disenfranchised or they're just disaffected youth, and they jumped on this cause because it's somewhere they can, you know, pump their fist and be upset about something. And it's, I mean, you don't want them on your side, and that's what cracks me up.
Well, now they can do it. They can do it collectively with Twitter and Facebook, and they can like each other, and they can take selfies.
They can like each other,
and they can sort of do it. They can do it in a clump in a group. And to that, I just say, okay, misery may like company. Well, there's going to be lots of company, lots of misery for these kids.
You'll have to excuse me, but every time I hear this, it's so to me, it's so infantile. Well, like me on Facebook. I keep thinking of lick me on Facebook. I mean, it's what it's like. What are you? Oh, have we all devolved? Are we all back in like middle school again? I mean, God, give me a break. With the technology increase,
Facebook. It just I don't know, these social networks. My nephew, I have a nephew who's very involved in the Twitter, almost to the detriment of his grades, and it's become an issue. And I'm sure he's just one of many, many kids who are getting caught up in this. You know, I'm grateful in many ways that we didn't have this. I mean, you've got about 7 years on me or so. You know, it's about as old. I'm as much older. My kid brother is 7 years younger than me. And so we're close enough in age. But we didn't have a lot of this stuff when we were kids. And I see the the influence that it's had on many kids, and the social skills are just going down the tubes on a steady basis.
forgive me for adding this, but it just gets so much better. I haven't read the last update that I got from Eric, but one of the statements he makes, he said the FedEx coworker who got Arthur, and Arthur's a pseudonym, who got Arthur thinking he is a sovereign citizen, has just lost some more property to the IRS. This is 15 years after she won the criminal case, but her lawyer co-opted some kind of plea bargain deal with the IRS in the civil case. So once the IRS has you in their sights, they do not give up. They keep digging and digging to get wealth back to the City of London / Vatican Access. She tried, quote, hiding – well, last sentence. She tried, quote, hiding wealth and property from them, but it all takes is a piece of paper or a digital signature somewhere, and it's over.
Well, sure, and not only that, she hired a lawyer, which was her mistake from the get-go.
That was one of the things I think that even Iman said a long, long time ago. If you're going to go in this thing alone and try to navigate, that's one thing. But as soon as you take a lawyer on, your goose is cooked because the lawyers are in the same brotherhood.
That's right.
So you get skunked right there, and that's what this guy did. He went ahead so far, he got a lawyer in, and nothing's ever been the same. And, you know, maybe it's a good segue back, but, you know, here's the thing that also I remember Iman saying about with all the anti-federalists and those who understood that things were not right with the Constitution being secretly devised, or actually adopted, to supplant the Articles of Confederation. Not that the Articles were great, it's just that you lied. But what he said also about those who agreed to go on with it and sign on, like Patrick Henry, and I said, well, these guys knew better. Why did they do it? And that's when Iman said, but above all things, they were lawyers.
And they are bound to the Pope. I have a statement here. The Holy See and civil governments, this is from National Canon Law, page 53. The Holy See and civil governments may be annulled by the Pope. There can be no doubt that the Holy See is bound as a general rule to observe these arguments. We say, as a general rule, for it is commonly held by canonists, that the pontiff may recede from concordats when there are just reasons for so doing. In fact, it is controverted, let's see, turn the page here, whether concordats are contracts proper or mere privileges. Again, it seems to be commonly admitted that in all agreements entered into by the sovereign pontiff, this condition is understood. And it has Latin, which I won't even try to butcher it, but it does have a translation in parentheses. In other words, unless you show cause of extraordinary evidence that you are not ruled by the Pope, you're presumed to be ruled by the Holy See.
Iman did not come out of the chute when doing interviews with me in the very beginning. I don't know. I assume it was because he didn't know if I would buy it. He didn't know that I knew, and I didn't know that he knew. But at one point, I said to him, it all goes back to the Vatican, and that's when he opened up.
I remember that interview.
Yeah.
I still listen to it from time to time. To this day, I still listen to that interview.
Once he knew that I was not going to look at him like he had seven heads, that's when he got right down into it. And he gave me some of his documents that he asked me never to show, which I'm going to abide by. I'm not saying that they're so sexy or anything, but it's just that he has the proof to show exactly what happens. And what he had said was that all law, no matter where it is subservient and should be a send-down of ecclesiastical law. Ecclesiastical law is the basis of everything. I think it's ecclesiastical law that kicked the Magna Carta to the sidewalk, if I'm not mistaken, for all the good that document did. Well, you know, I even had a laugh at the Declaration of Independence. It is so full of platitudes. It's so high-sounding and wonderful, and it brings tears to your eyes. You know, when somebody was saying about, well, you know, what about that document and all that, I'm like, so what about that document? You think the Brits got upset about that? The Brits laughed their asses off. I mean, it had no force of law, huh?
Written on hemp.
Oh, no, everybody's coming out now and saying, oh, no, that wasn't the case. You know, anyway. But the deal is, I mean,
and I'm in the middle of reading Washington and the Lap of Rome, and I'm in about, I don't know, maybe the two-thirds of the way through it. And the descriptions in that book, it's just scathing. And here's a guy who was right there. You know, people who think that history only goes back 50 years or so. People, I got to tell you something. You got to go back further. Even 100 years ain't much. But speaking of the hemp, I found a fascinating book. In fact, I have to thank you, and I can't remember who you were interviewing. It might have been Theo that talked about the emperor's. The emperor has no clothes.
The Emperor Wears No Clothes by Jack Herer.
Thank you. I have this book in front of me now. Well, actually, the first five chapters. I've been reading the first five chapters. People who think these founders were so holier than now. Well, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson grew cannabis on their plantations. And it's interesting because the word marijuana is a Mexican slang term that was used to deride the herb, to deride the plant. And I've said this before, that water may be the universal solvent. Hemp is the universal product. You can make anything out of hemp, anything literally from a needle to a battleship. It is the most versatile plant ever grown.
I mean, the fact that it was there, and if it was used to alleviate nausea, that's not the problem. I mean, the problem comes obviously with other things, and the way that it's made now with the THC and all that. But if you just leave the plant alone out there, it does have an amazing amount of properties. But as I think you heard us go on about, and this also involves alcohol. And what I did with Andy Sr., with Wayne Wheeler, the great prohibitionist, they went ahead and they demonized alcohol and marijuana on a moral level. However, what wasn't said was that Rockefeller, who had petroleum just come out and formed gasoline, did not want the competition from alcohol because they knew that farmers were using Applejack to run their vehicles, and some of the first cars that ever came out could run on a number of fuels, one of which happened to be alcohol. So in demonizing alcohol, and John D. Rockefeller was completely behind prohibition, he didn't give a crap about the moral fiber of the country. He didn't want that.
Of course
that,
not. These guys had the morals of alley cats.
Right. He did not want that as a threat to his petroleum, which, as we see to this very day, is the only source we're really ever allowed to use. Yeah, great with the solar cars. I get that. But you know what? It's not really meant to be pushed forward because we're supposed to stay on gasoline as an element of control when the gasoline goes up to 7 to 10 bucks a gallon. Also, in the same mode, they came out against marijuana or hemp because of the patents that were out there, I guess, with DuPont and Carnegie to come out with synthetic fibers.
DuPont in 1937 with rayon and some of the other fibers.
Right.
And in the early 1600s, there were actually orders to make all farmers grow Indian hemp seed. And there were mandatory hemp cultivation laws in Massachusetts in the 1630s. In Connecticut at the same time, and into the 1700s, the Chesapeake colonies actually mandated the growth of hemp. And in England, you could get a full British citizenship on foreigners who would grow cannabis. And if you refused, you were actually fined. So cannabis was legal tender money in most of America from the 1630s until the early 1800s.
Well,
and why? To encourage American farmers to grow more. You could pay your taxes with cannabis hemp throughout America for over 200 years.
Well, the reason it was demonized.
And I only mention these things, Al, because more suppressed history.
Yes,
how many people
right.
realize, if you're to ask the American person or the average person on the street about the properties of hemp, he'd give you a blank stare. He probably wouldn't even know what hemp was. You know, whereas you say marijuana, that's been the term plastered
right.
and bandied about ad infinitum. So everybody knows that, and it's pejorative.
Well, if you remember Reefer Madness and that campaign that came out, everybody knows nobody acts like that who smoked grass. I mean, they acted like they were doing.
You're going to sit in a corner and eat a box of Wheaties.
I know. But, I mean, anybody who acted like that, God knows what they were on, but it certainly would be speak more of taking cocaine. You know, than that. I mean, they're these people like off the walls, and it's like, no, man. But you see, that's what happened. There again, it starts with lies right away in the whole propaganda campaign, and because they get the bully pulpit, what can anybody say against it? Because those voices don't get out. So when people
it's
say, well,
like
how can
the informer said?
Well, I mean, when people talk about how can you keep a conspiracy quiet, it's like it isn't being kept quiet. A lot of people know. They just don't get themselves onto mainstream bullhorns so they can share that with everyone. If you don't get to the mainstream, nobody's hearing you. You could stand on the soapbox and you could convince 1,000 people a day, and it's not going to matter. So how do you keep a conspiracy quiet? You don't. You just don't let it get to like I said, the mainstream outlets, either in print or electronic, radio, TV.
It's interesting because Jefferson, you know, yes, a lot of these neocons today who worship him, if you were to say that Jefferson was actually a drug smuggler of a sorts, they'd just completely deny it. They'd probably take a poke at you. Well, he was an envoy. He was a law envoy to France, and he went to great expense and even risked to himself, and he had secret agents, to procure hemp seed smuggled illegally into Turkey from China. And the mandarins, the Chinese mandarins, the political rulers of the day, they valued their hemp seeds so much that they made its exportation a capital offense. So Jefferson, our boy was putting his head very close to the noose. So, you know, the dichotomy between the descriptions and the fantasies and the reality is so great as to be as wide as a canyon.
Well, I guess we're pretty much up against it. Do you have something you want to close out with that you can get in and get out with?
Yeah, I think I do. Well, I will mention Benjamin Franklin. He started one of America's first paper mills with cannabis. So, and there was sort of a financial advantage to this. So, you know, you could have a press without begging or justifying the need for paper and books from England. And I just have so many things here. The energy and the marijuana and, of course, the cancer research information that I would certainly like to get into in the future. But I see a lot of these events that are happening today, and I can't help but to go back to that the things that our patriots, the patriotards are saying, you know, we need to get back to the Constitution. We need to get back to the Constitution. Please, people, understand something and understand this well, that the problems we have are because of the Constitution. Not in spite of it.
Or the fact that people are spellbound by his existence and keep thinking it's some kind of like, I don't know, some magic elixir or something that's going to make everything right. But, you know, really what it comes down to, like most other things, if people don't really check it out for themselves, all it is, it becomes just a thing that's set. It's like a, you know, like a Chatty Cathy pull toy doll where people go, well, you know, we got to get back to the Constitution. We have to get back our government. You know, when did you ever have it to lose it, folks? Last thing I also would say, I never understood what corporate fascism really was or how it could be a problem, and now I understand fully. And my point is, no matter what you folks are doing with regard to parties, why is it that none of the legislatures for whom you vote ever do anything to stop Monsanto or any of the big corporations? They are having a field day, and our lawmakers are doing nothing but giving us theater. They're giving us the facade of having a process. But that's why I have to laugh with the patriots. You know, it's like, did it stop anything? No. Does Monsanto ever taken a step back? No. So at any rate.
No, not at all. And I wanted to say one last thing here, Al, about these politicians who pretend to be Christians. And I noticed that Clinton was a bit old Slick Willie was carrying around his Bible. I'm beginning to think it was a year's worth of Hustler between two hardcovers.
It was probably Jefferson's Bible.
Yeah, there you go.
There's a reason why it's his middle name. All right, we got to get out of here. Eric the Blacksmith, okay, thanks for being with us, and certainly
thank
this isn't the last.